Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, race in America in the wake of weirdness and sorrow. My guest is Sam Fullwood III. Sam is an old friend. He comes on to the program fairly frequently to talk about race. Sam is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Previously, he was a reporter at, among other places, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the L.A. Times, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and who knows where else. Sam, thanks for coming on the program again.
It's great to be with you, David, always.
You know, Sam, we wanted to talk about the bizarre case, the weird case of Rachel Dolezal, the white woman who's been posing as black and living in as a black woman. But in the wake of the tragic events in Charleston, South Carolina, we need to talk about both issues. In one way, the Dolezal case is a new story or a new variation on the American enigma of race. And in some ways, the Dylann Roof slaughter of 9 people in the AMA church in Charleston is an old story. How do you see these events?
You know, first off, it's just really, really tragic that that we live in a culture where someone who obviously, I mean, there's just no way of getting around it, isn't attached to rationality the way that most of us like to think of the world, has access to weapons, and can go into a place of worship and shoot 9 people. And to, in some way or another, believe that this is a noble thing, that this is going to lead to some sort of reaffirmation of a long-gone mythical kingdom in which white people are going to reign supreme. That is a really, really troubling and frightening development, given so much of what we've done in this country over the last 400 years, that anyone would even believe such a thing is possible. I mean, if you were to write this as a novel, no one would really believe it or should believe it. I think people would indeed believe it because for all of the talk that we wanted to think about of a post-racial society, race is still a very, very salient feature that sort of warps the fabric of our society.
Well, they'd believe it if it was a slightly different variation. You know, Sunni jihadi goes into Yazidi temple and slaughters everyone there and takes the women to use as sex slaves. So that would seem fairly medieval, but, you know, there's a parallel between what's going on in the Middle East, I suppose, and the likes of Dylann Roof.
You're absolutely right, David. There are mythologies that we tell ourselves that makes us feel comfortable. And one of those mythologies is the stranger bad guy from an alien culture who comes in and does horrible things to the good, virtuous people that we all are. And the more popular of those narratives now really does sort of have someone who's wearing a turban, who speaks a language that's kind of alien to American ears. But yet, homegrown terrorism doesn't seem to have that same kind of salience with us.
The case is incredibly sad. Am I right to think of it as another version of an old, horrible pattern?
I wish I could argue with you about that. I'm of an age where I, as a journalist, you mentioned earlier that I worked for newspapers. I worked for a lot of newspapers. I spent about 30 years in the newspaper business. And this story has repeated itself in one permutation after another. And I can remember writing stories, going back now almost 30 years, 25 years, when Rodney King was beaten in Los Angeles. And one of the stories that I wrote that my editors just really loved was this sort of discrepancy between what black people think they know and what white people in America think they know, even when they look at the exact same thing. So that there were people who watched Rodney King get beat, but they, based on the way in which they lived, the culture and their experiences in life, came away from that with totally divergent points of view. And I wrote that story around, 91, 92, and then not too much later after that, wrote about it in a different context with O.J. Simpson, or wrote about it with in talking about the way in which people viewed the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearing on Capitol Hill. This is another one of those kinds of stories. The details of what happened may be different and horrific and graphic, but the way in which the rest of us sort of view that is really filtered through our own lived experiences, and it doesn't make us any closer to understanding it or understanding each other.
I'm talking with Sam Fullwood from the Center for American Progress about race in America in the context of the two recent stories, the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, and the odd case of Rachel Dolezal. Talk about Miss Dolezal, Sam.
Where do you begin? Do you begin with the white Rachel Dolezal, or do you begin with the black Rachel Dolezal? You have the story of a woman who, at some point in her life, so closely identified with the black struggle in America that she renounced her white family and her white upbringing and began to call herself or identify herself as a black person. I think she was very pointed that she doesn't like the term African American. And then for 10 years lived that way, seemingly with no one paying any attention to it. And then all of a sudden is outed under mysterious circumstances, which I still don't really understand how her story came into public view. But nonetheless, was identified as having lived the last 10 years as a black person, when in fact she really was, biologically, if that's such a thing, white. And it has become something of a media sensation since that story broke. I think that this is truly one of those stories that doesn't deserve the attention that it's gotten, or at least not the way it has been reported. I mean, I think what is significant about Rachel Dolezal isn't Rachel Dolezal. It's the way in which the rest of America has responded to her. I am not aware of any white person who has ever passed themselves off as a black or an African-American person in the history of America.
Well, there was the book where the reporter went underground for a month or something, you know, Black Like Me, but that was a month. It wasn't 10 years and going to Howard University and becoming the head of a chapter of the NAACP.
Yeah, he never renounced permanently.
Right.
His whiteness.
No, it was just a reporting trip, essentially.
It was a device for him. I'm not aware of anybody who has, and to this day, she is still considering herself black. She says she lives the black experience. That raises a really interesting question to me that's far more important than her. And that question is, what is a black experience? What's a white experience?
Wow.
What is there that constitute making you black or white? Is it your lived experience? Is it a set of circumstances? Is it biology? Well, almost everybody tells us now that biology doesn't really figure into it. So what is it that she's appropriating or projecting that would make her or disqualify her? It's just as equally, you know, the reverse. What would disqualify her from being a black person? And I think that therein is a discussion that our society ought to be engaging in far more so than, you know, the plight of what is seemingly a confused woman.
Well, maybe this is one of those cases where a conversation starts because of this odd event. But you bring up some very fascinating points. But the first sort of reaction I had was, well, isn't this fascinating? You know, a black person can't just declare themselves white in America and say, I'm white. But here's somebody trying to
do
the reverse.
Actually, David, there is a small body of black people who have actually done that. And it's known as passing. The whole fabrication of race goes back to the notion of the one drop rule. If you have one drop of black blood in you, by legal purposes in the South, you were black. So there were a lot of black people who had an ancestor, say maybe a great-great-grandfather who was black. For legal purposes, that person was black. But they phenotypically looked white. And they could very easily pass because from slavery to the present, what advantage is there in a society that is as racist as ours to be black? And so if you had the opportunity to escape that, some people took it.
Right.
The converse of that isn't as likely. If the advantage is to being white, why would you renounce that?
Right. It's like a parallel is a gay person once said to me about, you know, his children and whether, you know, someone asking them whether he hoped they would be gay too. He said, "Are you kidding? Who would choose to be gay with all the crap you have to take?" You know,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's not to say that you're not proud to be gay or you're not proud to be black or you're not proud to be white. It's just who would choose to take the position of someone that is societally oppressed? And
right.
Nobody would do that. But Rachel did it. Rachel Dolezal did that. And that's a really interesting question to me. Maybe one day when her book is done or her Lifetime series or whatever it is that she's going to do with her life, it'll become a little bit clearer. But I think that that says a lot about our construction and our fabrication of what race is in our society. And that's a far more interesting question to me than anything else that I'm hearing people talk about.
Okay, so Sam, what is the black experience then? Since you want to have a conversation about it, here's your time.
Well, I don't believe that there is anything that we can divide out and say it is the definitive black experience, because it is a lot of things, and no two sets of people, no two group of people have the exact same experience. I grew up in North Carolina to parents who were black. I have considered myself black all my life, but I have friends, indeed I have relatives who've grown up in other parts of the country, say in Seattle, Washington, and their experience is totally different from mine. Because we are both phenotypically dark-skinned, we both have had the same black experience. I don't think that's a fair thing to say. I know some white people. I work with some white people whose experiences are much, much closer to mine than some black people. Are they that much alien to me? You know, our society imposes these kinds of barriers and restrictions on us when it's just really, to my way of thinking, really foolish to even ask the question, no offense, David, what is the black experience? here's how I would compare it. If you and I were to take a ride on a spaceship and circle the Earth, and we were to look down at the globe, how would we know where the line of demarcation is between the United States and Canada? We wouldn't. It is one big blob of land mass and water that we're looking down on it. But if we sort of in our mind's eye, we sort of can see the shape of the continents, and we have it in our mind where that line is, it's not anything that's real. It's something that we have imposed to give order that's artificial. And I think the same way about race.
Sam, you know, what this really leads me to think is that we're going to be having a lot more conversations.
I think that it is an eternal conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we will never get to the point where it all goes away. The bottom line is that we're humans, and humans have always struggled with trying to find meaning in their lives. I think you have to have faith that the struggle will continue even if we don't get the definitive answer.
Well, Sam Fullwood, Center for American Progress, thanks as always, my friend.
Good to talk to you, David.